Culture eats strategy for lunch, and informed cultures drive decisions and inspire action. At the Data Culture Podcast, we talk with execs, visionaries, and data experts so that you may move from idea to outcome in your own data culture journey. Welcome to the Data Culture Podcast. My name is Sid Atkinson, data culture innovator and consulting leader with over 21 years in data. And with us today is Holly Smith from Databricks. Holly, welcome. Good to have you on
today. Hello, hello. I'm excited to be here.
Oh, it's going to be a fun discussion. But in the kind of the premise here is if we look at, used to say the phrase software is eating the world. And it's, so 2011. So AI is eating the world and at this blistering pace. And so while a lot of this feels like hyperbole and in some cases faked gains, maybe to call out who did that just recently, but many initiatives in data and AI are very real and organizations are adopting, adapting cultures to include these gains. But this also can feel like an astounding pace of change. And so lots of anxiety. How am I doing? How do I stay current? Is RAG even going to be a thing a year from now? So Holly serves as a director developer advocate, and she has spent her career in various analyst, data science, consulting, and architecture roles. So today's episode and her experience and all of her career is talking about how do you find your tribe? How do you learn and grow? Holly.
Thank you so much. And whilst I appreciate my promotion into director of developer advocacy, it is a staff developer advocate.
Apologies.
Yeah. But that's how you know that this is real content and not AI generated because, we're calling out mistakes.
Thank you for pointing out how bad I am at reading LinkedIn sometimes.
Maybe it's not clear. What do we know? Okay. Yep. So thank you so much for having me here. This is something that I'm incredibly passionate about. A bit about my background. Mm-hmm. So I currently work at Databricks, absolutely loving it, having a great time here. But I started off very much from my perspective on the back foot. So mm-hmm. I did a maths degree that is very useful, but I didn't really learn how to kind of code or how to do anything practical until I became an analyst. And I did that at Lloyds Banking Group, which is one of the UK's largest banks that we have here. And I spent a lot of time crunching numbers, but I wasn't very good at technology. Mm-hmm. And was I a whiz at Excel? Absolutely. Then I moved into data science because it was like stats modeling before it was cool. But again, that was very kind of SaaS based and less about kind of practical kind of deployment things. And I didn't necessarily have like the fundamental kind of computer science. And then I think the kind of writing was on the wall for me in terms of big UK bank is never going to be at the forefront of technology, in my opinion. Please don't sue me. But I saw that this was something that was so important to so many different organizations and I wanted to get better at it. So I threw myself headfirst into joining Databricks. Why they hired me, I've got no idea, because frankly, as much as I knew like data and how to manage teams with data, and I understood the kind of business outcomes in terms of kind of the guts of how these things are made and what's needed, there was a bit of a gap there. So when I joined Databricks, and again, Databricks is great. It hires very smart people, and somehow I slipped through the net. And I'm also sorry to tell everyone that our hiring processes have improved dramatically since then. But I felt very much on the back foot. I remember going in and trying to learn about Spark and people saying, oh, yeah, it runs on the JVM. And I'd be like, what's a JVM? It says a Java virtual machine. I'd be like, yeah, I don't know what one of those is either. So there was a lot that I had to learn. And I spent the last 5 years really a lot of hard graft to try and learn and understand things. And I understand how challenging it is to do these things as well,
Yeah, I think there's a lot that you're going to draw from. And first off, Holly, I think there's so many people that are like your experience, right? Like it's very rare when we say, oh, I got Databricks certified in college or undergrad or whatever it is. And I came out of school knowing how to be a consultant or know how to do these things. We were literally going to have an intern start next month going to a great university in here in the US. But the practical applied pieces are just, I get it, right? There's only so much you can do in a college education for. But I think there's been this wonderful self-taught piece, right? And so kudos to you to not thinking a JVM coming from the banking sector is just a really cool way to make coffee.
I'd like to think I understand the challenges that come with that. And I don't think they're often talked about that much. And I feel like the way that we approach a lot of these technology things, people don't necessarily frame it in a way to say, yeah, it's okay if you don't really understand things, but here's how to get started. And so it seems very timely to be talking about this because I have this hypothesis that, I don't know, of all the people doing Gen AI today, 2 years ago, I reckon like 95% of them, they weren't doing this. So it's this kind of novel space where it's new, it's emerging. Everybody's probably new at it, unless you're an academic who's been doing this for your entire life, but this is probably not for you. And so many people are doing this and stepping into it. And it's interesting to watch who are the ones who want to step into it or want to give it a go. Who are the ones who are maybe holding back? I'm like, that's okay.
Yeah.
I think it might be a fad. But it's very interesting, especially with so much momentum behind all of the AI stuff that's come out recently, to see, you know, when people want to get started, how do they go about doing it?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting piece that we were talking about prior to this call, like in preps. And I say this a lot. Hey, Kali's got a lot of experience. The guests we have lots of experience. So what's the passion topic? What do you want to talk? And in your kind of developer advocacy, it's drawing on, hey, I was self-taught. I, Holly, had to learn so much. Let me go help other people to learn. But yeah, to your point, like this pace of change is insane. As you are working in your official position and prior lives before, prior to Databricks, how do you help or guide people focus on their learning? What are some of the ways that you look at? How do I frame learning? How do I develop learning models? Things like that.
Yeah, so learning models makes it sound incredibly formal. It's it's really not.
Yeah.
It's for me, it's putting the systems in place that mean that you don't necessarily have to try every day. I think that generally tends to suck as an objective. It's just, I'm just going to try really hard all the time. And then it'll happen. No, you're going to have days when you are tired, you're going to be exhausted, you're not going to be in the mood for it. And so it's the kind of systems that you put in place to be in a situation where you're going to be learning. So for example, for me, I've always tried to make sure that I've been in a role where I am always learning something. It's nice to be senior, it's nice to be the most experienced person in the team, but if that's hindering your growth, that's probably a sign to maybe start thinking about other things that's going to push you to do this. I would also say that you don't necessarily have to be learning all day, every day. It is completely fine if you want to, if you have other priorities in life and maybe you want to spend a couple of years taking the pressure off yourself. But for the rest of the time, how do you keep updating your skills? How do you keep learning things? Again, trying to make this kind of a lower pressure thing to be able to do this. So it's something that's a bit more continuous learning as well. So again, putting yourself in kind of those scenarios. Trying to do 1% a day is going to be a lot better than 100% for 1 week or one quarter. Like those things tend not to help you with things like that. So yeah, like being in the scenario where you can do things like that and learn from the people around you. And if you're lucky, that can be your career in terms of the people around you that you're learning from. If you don't have that option, or maybe there's other draws to the work that you're liking to do, when it comes to like, where do you get your inspiration from? Who is it who is pushing you to learn more and kind of challenge these ideas? Are you familiar with the Dunning-Kruger effect? Yeah, I see a nod. For anyone who's listening and maybe doesn't know, it's a trade-off between when you start to learn and you don't know anything, and then you get to this point where you do start knowing things, but you don't know what you don't know. And so it's trying to push into that kind of, I don't know what I don't know. That's something that you want to understand. And again, that either can come from the people that you're working with, but it can also come from other online communities as well. So if you are part of, there's a lot of Slack channels, there's a lot of online groups, like LinkedIn groups or whatever, that can show you like the art of the possible is out there. And some people choose to do it that way. Maybe it's conferences that you're going to where you're learning what other people are doing to help you stay on topic and kind of focus on kind of newer things that you can be doing. And again, it's not something necessarily that you have to understand all of it all the time, but it is challenging yourself to say, okay, then when do you really feel out of your depth? Versus when do you kind of have a passing knowledge in something and have enough of an understanding to say, actually, yes, I think this is worth more exploration versus, no, this is too much. This is too much detail for me.
I think an important aspect I heard in all of those different bits of knowledge that you dropped there was like finding a way to hold yourself accountable, right? And as you mentioned, it's like some people want high pressure, some people might want low pressure. So there's a little bit of know thyself, right? What do you strive under? And then adapt like what you strive under. Some people might like being like the pebble under the boulder and become the diamond. Other people are not going to enjoy that aspect of it. I was actually just having coffee with one of my old coworkers this morning. We just get together and share ideas and mentorship and learn from each other. And one of the things, he had moved from technical delivery where we had worked together to now entirely pre-sales, is, oh my gosh, that I've learned so much, like more in the last year and a half. Like, I get why we would joke like, technical delivery is easy. Okay, let's not undersell technical. There is a lot of aspect of technical delivery. It's hard, Seth. But technical delivery is easy compared to sales because you're dealing with the messiness of people. There's a whole lot of emotions and understanding politics. And you got to get uncomfortable asking a lot of things and understanding a lot of things. But for him, that's, for some people, that's just water off a duck. For him, massive learning. And he has that constant pressure of meeting the sales quota and everything else to hit. And so some people are going to be riding, like he is rising to that and doing well and having fun, stressed at times. He's got to find, he's been finding the balance on that pressure. And that is, there's many ways, as you're saying, to hold yourself accountable to learning. He's got this corporate pressure to holding himself accountable to learning. And mm-hmm. you're speaking as there's, if you're looking at other aspects, yeah, but I think all of it is, how do you find that accountability? Because one thing I found is, to your point, like, we are very good at doing things when others expect us to do it. We're very bad at doing it when we expect ourselves to do it. So, no, love that insight.
Yeah, learning in a vacuum is inherently hard, and like, kind of knowing yourself. And something that I would add is that for me, part of knowing myself and from what I see from other people is things tend to be quite stressful sometimes to learn these things. Mm-hmm. There's good stress and bad stress. There's a bit of good stress in there to learn new things, literally push yourself outside mm-hmm. of your comfort zone. By definition, is going to be uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. But the amount of times I reflect back and I look at a challenge and I'm like, oh my goodness, I understand absolutely nothing about this particular thing. And then I go and learn about the thing. And maybe 6 months later, and I look back and I'm like, oh, that wasn't actually that hard. Like, a lot of these things coming from finance, coming from tech as a background, these are two groups of people who love to put lots of buzzwords and like specific language about things. And it does get
Wait, you're not accusing tech of hype, are you?
Even hype, just using challenging words that are not plain English,
yeah,
which makes it incredibly challenging to learn these things. And again, this is part of what I'm passionate about doing now, is being able to explain things in plain English that don't assume that you've got 3-4 years of formal education in computer science, for people who have come in from like different routes and different entries. The amount of times I see kind of security experts come in, and now all of a sudden they want to use data in a better way. And they are technical people and they do understand broader tech. But when it comes to data, there is a big old mismatch, and people assume, oh, tech, so therefore I don't have to rephrase any of these things. I don't have to shy away from the super technical language. Actually, that's kind of a bit of a misnomer. And the amount of times that I'll have something that's on some slides and someone's told me the words that kind of they've said before, and if I reframe it in a different way, the amount of people that come up to you afterwards, like, oh, Holly, thank you so much. I actually understood that. I was up there thinking, hang on a minute. I thought you were smarter than me. What's going on here?
We say this a lot in data, but it's having common language, a lexicon, a code book that everybody understands. It's actually very difficult, right? Like even like that, if you look at the problems, even in business and understanding something as simple or what ostensibly should be as simple as net margin, and yet still confounds people to this day across so many different companies and even inside their own company. So if they have that problem and they're filing taxes, they have GAAP, they have all this other stuff that they're, and they're still having this challenge. We have to have a little bit of humility as we walk into the room. And just, hey, you know, what SIG means to me probably means something different to you. Like what COE Absolutely. Means to me probably means something different to you. Maybe you have a completely different standpoint on that. So when you're looking at like some of these companies that you've worked with either prior to Databricks or with some of your customers and the folks that you're helping get up to speed, how have you seen cultures impact learning and growth?
I'm glad we're going to talk about this because it is wild the amount of deviation that you see. You have some companies who are terrified of kind of change or are terrified of wanting to make differences. And then you've got some that are very open to trying new things. And it's links to like this tolerance for inertia. Mm-hmm. So you've got some companies who are very hesitant to try anything new. And I'm not going to necessarily say that one is necessarily good or bad, because I think at the extremes, it does have its negatives. So for mm-hmm. example, if you're trying every single new shiny thing, you're probably not delivering much in the way of business value. And as someone who works a lot with the cutting edge, let me tell you, it cuts and it hurts sometimes. And you don't want that every single project. Sometimes if you want to build a house, just use bricks. That's fine. You can use the proven tech stack. That's absolutely fine. Mm-hmm. But then you've got the flip side as well. We've been using the same data technology for the last 30 years. I don't possibly see why we could go for anything new. But even like when working and doing like particular different types of deliveries, it comes out in very interesting ways. When it comes to particular projects and deliveries, things like when you are talking about timelines or kind of uncertainty, there are some people that I've worked with really enjoy it where they're saying, oh, Holly, we want to try out this new thing. What about if we do XYZ? The features come out 2 weeks ago. And I say, you know what? I don't think anyone's ever asked that question before. Let me do some research and I'll get back to you. And they say, cool, speak on Monday. Whereas with other teams that I work with, if I say, oh, I don't really know. Let me find out, come back to you. That is an abhorrent thing to say. How do you not have certainty of absolutely everything that is going on? And that then leads into things like project plans, which are incredibly like waterfall based, and they've got no tolerance for something being not quite the way that it was designed up front, or if you need a lot more time to figure out like what's the best way, because there's maybe like one, two, maybe three options of what you've got to do, and it's not until you actually do the work that you figure out like what is the right thing for that particular project that you are doing. And you can also see this in kind of people as well. So there are, again, some people that are willing to try a new thing. And again, I think part of it is getting over this fear or this idea of, oh, learning a new thing, that's really hard. Sometimes it's just sat there with a bunch of documents open and just having an afternoon of your mind clear to be able to test things out. But for others,
net teams and giving them some advice, how do you figure out whether, hey, I'm dealing with something that might be the pace of an individual versus the pace of the company, like the group? Because then we're talking about, it's like that, I think one of the terms you used earlier when we were talking was like punishing learners, right? Do we have a company that, a culture that punishes, and we don't have to call anybody out, right? We're not going to do that. But for the broader education of the many, right? What do you look at when you're giving or looking at, is this the individual or is this the culture, then the surrounding processes for the person?
Generally, you can see it in the trend across the team. If you've got one person who is insistent on using the same tech stack they've been using for 20 years and everyone else around them is like, well, it's probably not going to be for us.
Yeah.
That's a dead set. One outlier, a dead set. And the things that I like to do in my role is to be able to help people to say, okay, then I understand that you've had a lot of success in your career with this particular thing, but you can have a lot of success in your career with this other thing as well. Mm-hmm. And the learnings kind of transfer, even if it's going to be a bit uncomfortable for a few months, for maybe a year or so, you're going to get a lot more longevity out of it. For a lot of people, that's a big, big one. Versus when you see it at a company level, this tends to be everyone's got very similar attitudes, but it also comes into the project planning, the kind of shortlisting of what it is that they want to do, what are the projects that they want to do, what is their appetite to test out these different things. Now, I appreciate that sometimes procurement cycles get in the way, and like you trying to do a 3-month test of something that took 9 months to get through procurement is probably not going to be a great use of everyone's time. Yeah. Sometimes you can't do that. You don't exist within that environment. But there are other times as well where it's like, oh, maybe we're not using this thing to its full potential. And maybe we could stitch together some of the things that we have already. And again, it's that kind of willingness to be uncertain and the types of kind of project plans and delivery plans that you see coming out.
If I might summarize or maybe try a different lens on some of the things you just said there. And I think we can easily conflate this in companies, right? And in organizations, learning and experimentation, right? So it's hard to, there's many times you can look at organizations, oh, we're all about learning. Look at all of how we track continuing education. But learning without application, you quickly forget and it's not applied. So yeah, so talk about that a little bit. When you're looking at these, like what are things as patterns where both learning and experimentation can go hand in hand? What are some of those like kind of patterns in good cultures that you see?
Yeah, so good cultures I would see are people having the ability to learn in a way that suits them. Mm-hmm. So let's say, hypothetically, a company has bought a new platform and people have to learn how to use it. Is there a structured learning plan in place? Or can people do the formal training courses if they want to? Could they do something at their own pace in kind of Udemy? Do they have the option to go to conferences? Do people have ways to learn, but in their own kind of their own kind of style? One of my friends did evening classes. Some of my friends have taken time out to go back and do some formal education for a year. But for a lot of people, maybe that's not so practical. And they are a big fan of sometimes just taking an afternoon or whatever to really dive into the detail of what these things mean. I think I also want to mention tools that we've got at the moment that really help people with this AI stuff. And not all of it is a massive hype. There are some fantastic products out there that I personally find help with my understanding. Things like Perplexity AI, I have a license for that. And just being able to harass it constantly with questions like, I don't understand this thing.
Yeah.
And it will link you to a document. I think 2 years ago, I tried to write a talk with the help of ChatGPT. And yes, it did help. But my goodness, did I make some bold claims that when it went to fact-checking, it did not pass the bar. Things like that are able to help. Again, things like Copilot as well, or whatever your code editor tool of choice is. Mm-hmm. Is also fantastic for helping people to get there faster. And I'm a big fan of hands-on learning to really speed things up. Having said which, if you're an executive, I spoke to a lot of friends who have much more senior jobs than I do. And for a lot of them, they say the other executives that they see who are very effective at what they do, they have the kind of humility to say, oh, I don't really understand what this thing is. And they're great at asking questions to their team, the things they think they should know, or the things they think they should understand. And that's not necessarily a, oh, can you talk me about, I don't know, tokenization strategies and LLMs? That's probably not it. It's things like, why is this thing taking so long? And if we get it wrong, what are the impacts? Oh, okay, that's very interesting. Okay, if there is a, I don't know, tiny margin of error, we spend less time on it. And that kind of openness to say, oh, I don't really understand, but I want to know more. Whereas there are some executives that I think we've all seen, particularly with something like data, where people just say, oh, no, I'm not a data person. No, I don't understand. And then that's it. That's the end. Not really wanting to get in. I don't want to say get stuck in, like I'm not expecting executives to learn how to code in Python, but how willing are they to fix a load of gaps in their knowledge that they might have?
Yeah, these are wetware statistical processes that are happening in between our ears on a minute by minute, second by second basis, whether you're ready to admit that or not. I can't remember what the measure was, but the amount of information that we take in a second is insane. And we process a lot. We do a lot with that. So to say that you are not a data person is to actually deny your humanness in a way. So I try not to point that out because sometimes it can be obnoxious to some audiences. But I think one thing I heard you say, and there's a whole lot of talk about this, particularly like in lean and manufacturing and other arenas, and certainly a lot with looking at like the failures of a certain airplane manufacturer recently, mm-hmm. psychological safety, right? Like so when you look at things I heard you say about successful learning cultures is the safety to pursue. Hey, we're going to go do something new, which is like alone, just making the decision to move off a platform that might've been ideas, architectures that might've been successful in the past. Now I want to try something new and different because I'm going to pursue new and different and better. Got to give people the room to learn and grow. Got to make that decision to go do something new. Executives that are willing to say, I don't know everything, teach me, right? That's like a culture of safety and saying, we're all here together. We're all going to learn. Like there is the memes you see all the time on LinkedIn is what I learned from school, what I learned by failure, right? Like it's the stack on what I learned by actually being able to be human, to experiment, to fail. So it's really, the question is, how do we fail safely? Like how do we enable people to experiment and fail safely so that when the stakes are high, I can have a much better chance of success for whatever it is I'm doing. Like experiment a lot. You came from banking, right? Experiment a lot with how to debit and credit balances, but then make sure, really sure when that launches, when the code you do launches, that it works. But I can't get there unless I experiment and test.
Yeah. So I think in terms of the context of the business, so for example, when I see kind of people being successful with generative AI at the moment, normally it's an internal use case that they're mm-hmm. doing. So if it does turn out that it's spouting offensive things because employees asked it offensive things.
Yeah.
We're all going to have a trip to HR right now, which is very different from something external facing, which is a lot more high risk because there might be things going on there. But I'd also say from a personal perspective as well. So again, when I was a consultant, this is a journey that I had to learn. Like I was terrified of telling people that I didn't know the answer. Even if the question is completely unreasonable, I would just try and say something on the spot. And I realized that the amount of times I had to go back and correct something mm-hmm. that I was confidently incorrect about, or at least gave the impression of, probably wasn't underneath, but to be able to say that. And there are projects and times to do it, and then times that there's not to do it. Experiment on the smaller side from the personal side. If you've got a project where it's not as high pressure, just test things out and saying different ways of saying, I don't know, and see how people react. And I think you'd be surprised. Most people feel like, oh, wow, that's a really big question. I don't have an answer for you now, but I can find an answer for you soon. That's a fine thing to say. Obviously, if you're there and you're meant to be the expert and that's your answer to everything, that can be very challenging. But for a lot of people, they're not necessarily paid by the hour, by the day. So that kind of takes the pressure off a little bit. And then you do get a lot better at being able to say, I don't know, or, you know, that's not really within my remit. For example, like I focus a lot on data engineering. I have done stats and a bit of machine learning, but if someone asks me like a very specific nuance about how to use AI, I tend to like absolutely not a clue. And so I'm more than happy to tell people it's not really my area of expertise. It's not going to stop me having a look at the documentation to be like, oh, is this going to answer your question? If not, let's go find someone else.
I love that you actually brought the consulting experience, because like a pivot that we would teach our teams to do, right, is that, and it's back to that safety aspect. So I get the pressure to know everything can be extreme. But then, you know, the knowing that the team is going to support this answer, right? It's teaching, where do you place the confidence? You place the confidence in like my ability as the person on this team and with all my team behind me that we can solve this. Here's what I know. Here's what I don't know. I think this might apply these experiences that I have or the team has. This amalgamation of events is new, unique and new. And this is probably what we can bring to the table that makes it. But you have to have the safety in the team knowing that, hey, the leadership's going to support you giving that answer to the client. But what are anti-patterns that you see in cultures from the innovation and growth and learning?
Yeah, so anti-patterns. Yeah, I definitely think kind of people not leaning in and mm-hmm. it constantly having this cycle of being outsourced. So I see this a lot in kind of working groups or initiatives that get set up, or I see this a lot in, again, also a lot of low confidence environments as well. So I have done a lot of work with nonprofits. And I would describe that as a fairly low confidence environment because they're doing lots of other things. They're not necessarily data people. Mm-hmm. And you end up with kind of a room full of people not really knowing and no one really taking the reins to get stuck in and get started. They just say all the buzzwords and then convince themselves that they're making progress. Mm-hmm. There is a concept called bike shedding. I'm not sure if that's okay from your face. No, it's, not, it's the idea that like a group of people have got to build a nuclear power plant, but they don't know how to do that. So they focus all of their time on making what designs and what the bike sheds should look like. And In my experience, that tends to come from a lot of people not being, lots of people putting their hands up and saying, oh, I don't know, and I can possibly know. And that can get really extreme, right? So for example, I've seen some companies outsource the vast majority of their data work. Mm-hmm. And maybe for some businesses, that's the right choice, but I'm yet to see one because that's such an important thing to be able to do. Now, is it like a one-off migration project? Sure. But in terms of all of that innovation, all of that business value that you could be getting out of it, just constantly outsourcing it, no one's taking any responsibility for it, that tends to be a giant anti-pattern that I see.
Yeah.
I think one of the other things is not giving people the opportunity to be able to learn. Mm-hmm. If everyone's at 120% capacity all the time, all year round, that's not going to lead to very happy outcomes. Again, not giving people the resources. I've heard of some companies that kind of get a budget, or you get to kind of train credits. So maybe you get £1,000 for the year, that's quite generous, £500 for the year. Mm-hmm. Do you get to spend that on books? Do you get to spend it on conference tickets? Do you get to spend it on training? Not giving anyone kind of anything to be able to do that, not even being able to expense a book, I think is particularly damning. Mm-hmm. If it's £8 for a book, maybe at 20 if it's a really fancy book, I don't know. It's just such a tiny thing. Yeah. And you've got an employee who's committed to spending all of that time reading that book, which is probably not going to happen during office hours. And yet you don't give people the opportunity for it. So meeting people where they're at, if you've got people that want to learn, and giving them the opportunities to be able to do that. And then the kind of flip side, which is no one wanting to learn and no one really wanting to take any kind of accountability for it. That tends to be the other big one as well.
And I have seen that when you don't have the leadership or the executive team committed to learning, right? Or if there's disparity between what they might do for themselves versus what they might do for others. It's, wow, okay, so they just went off overseas for a master's program, but then we're getting grief about sending somebody to a conference? And not even like a bunch of people, just a couple. So those are when there's discrepancies between, and vast discrepancies between how learning is encouraged. An anti-pattern to me.
There's one thing that I just thought of, or just remembered, which really every time I hear it being said, I think this is absolutely crackers. Generally, sending a handful of people on a training course and then expecting them to come back and then being a perfect trainer to teach everyone else back at the company. And sometimes this is like a center of excellence model where you pluck a few people from various teams, you put them all in one team. It's like, you're going to be the experts and then you're going to work together. And then a year later, we're going to put you back in your old team and hope that by osmosis, like that's the only way that we're going to upskill everyone. That seems crazy to me. Just because you're a practitioner does not mean that you're going to be great at teaching other people. Yes, you might be good at coaching kind of one or two people who are more junior. But for context, I've been a trainer at Databricks and I don't just turn up on day one and have the slides and off we go. It took me months to get it. I'd shadow so many different courses. I'd do dry runs. My plants behind me, they have had so many different training courses said to them because I practice out loud at home. I think that kind of model is also optimal. When not necessarily a lot of thought has been put into, okay, then what are different ways that we can do this? It tends to come down to a cost-cutting thing as well. Learning does take money. It's not the most expensive thing in the world compared to some other things, but it does take a bit of funding.
And that, I think, my experience has been with leadership. It's, as you mentioned, it's like lack of a plan and hoping that just throwing things at the wall and it all sticks is going to be the strategy, right? So it's...
Oh. The amount of times, your team is saying that you don't know a huge amount about Databricks. And so we gave them a LinkedIn Learning subscription and it's not made any difference. But yeah, that's because there's hundreds of thousands of hours of content on there and it's not been curated for anyone. And there's just so much out there and people could go down different tangents and people need some kind of guide rails on there. If I think about if I were to make, I don't know, a Databricks training course where I taught literally every aspect of Databricks. It might take hundreds of hours. Mm-hmm. And if you just have people pick their own adventure when it came to Databricks, maybe you wouldn't end up with the things that are practical for the project that you're about to work on. So I do think that's like the super unstructured. It's a nice middle ground. You don't want, there's only one way of learning, but at the same time, you don't want, okay, and there's all the internet information out there. Go learn it. Yeah. That's also not very practical either.
I've seen a lot of different company cultures over time. And what is a tragedy to me is that we have all the evidence in the world that people love to be excellent at their jobs. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of people love to be excellent at their work. They strive for excellence and that they will spend time learning. And then to not harness like all that energy in any kind of coordinated fashion with rewards and incentives for people to continue to be excellent at this is just insane to me. It's like, with the stat a while back was that more hours are spent writing code for open source than there is for the code that goes into projects like what Databricks or Microsoft or AWS have, right? Like more hours are spent on that. Now, that's skewed a little bit by big companies supporting those open source projects now. But before we had the mass subsidization, like it was still a true number. And you look at consulting or anything like that, it's like loads of people spend time working and learning in the off hours and to apply. So find ways like harness positively that and find ways to support it.
Yeah, I agree. And I do think that's a big one for kind of mobility. If not everyone has the mental bandwidth or even the time available to do this all in their spare time. I'm very sympathetic to people. Like work is from 9 to 5 to me. And when I go home, I'm a parent, I'm a carer. I just don't want to think about this stuff because I'm retiring in 5 years. That's fine. And again, this idea that you're ask people to do it in their spare time, I think is quite unreasonable. And getting people to do it as part of their day job is why I'm so passionate about it, to allow people to do it as part of their projects, as part of their day job, and not putting in extra effort on a Friday afternoon to learn something, because it's just not sustainable.
No, absolutely not. And that's, and the point is, when we have so many people that are eager to learn, both in the company and on their own time, like, why aren't we doing a better job of this? It's still crazy that we haven't cracked the nut. It's like when Malcolm Hawk and I were having a conversation a while back, I was like, we're still talking about the pursuit of business value in data projects. Why is this still, this is a conversation 20 years ago when our hair was less gray, and the fact that it's still a conversation has made our hair more gray. And maybe at some point this will stop being a conversation. Maybe Gen AI will solve, actually not Gen AI, the AGI will solve that for us. Tell us how we're all being asinine. Stop being stupid. Move on with life. The other bit, and I love that about that, the outsourcing all your data work, right? Like and I'm saying this as a consultant who makes money doing data work for clients, right? So to me, it's like data is everything. It's like your history of your company. It's your history of your interactions. It's so much about you. So why would you give that up? Why would you not understand how to use that? And so it's, to me, it's like there is an inherent bias being in the data space that you should know that. You should know how to use it.
Yeah, I think that links back to in the olden days, decades and decades ago, the way you ran the technology as a CTO would be to outsource as much as possible for as cheap as possible. Mm-hmm. It wasn't as complex then. There was less that could go wrong. It was less strategic to the overall business. And that is something that is not kept up. That does not hold true today. Yeah. And again, I think it's this idea of needing to, I don't want to say lean in, but like this idea of wanting to get more involved and also the confidence to be able to say, I can do it in a much better way than you can. I'm not very happy with what it is that you're doing, and I think we can do it better. And the more ingrained it has been as an outsourcing culture, if you have never really had much of a data team, and now all of a sudden you're going to start bringing this back on and you've got to hire 100 people and you don't really have kind of the structure in place, maybe you don't have a career path in place, what people want, how do you attract someone to do that? And then to be successful about it. And again, the kind of experimentation and iteration is very important there. But if you're used to outsourcing things, you're maybe not going to be as open-minded to doing something like this when you're used to seeing, oh, we're going to do this project for you. It's going to take 12 months and this is how much it's going to cost.
Yeah.
The end. And all of a sudden, you've got all of this kind of like mental space taken up by you trying to bring it in. So I understand why it happens, but I don't think it's a particularly successful approach.
Yeah. So then if we look at for it, those listening and they want to identify, hey, when am I in a good learning culture? And it's back to the questions that you have to ask yourself is, am I okay with the culture I'm in? Or am I going to seek to go find something different? And, you know, as you alluded to earlier, maybe the culture I'm in is good for my point in life or my point in my career. High learning and growth cultures are going to be ones that say, hey, we are willing to experiment. We are willing to fail. There's safety in saying, I don't know, and I've got a team and I can go figure this out, and the tools exist. Like, learning is a target and it's backed by action, not just by stating. So time is given, yeah. Budget's given, things like that. These are markers to look for, as you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. And it doesn't have to be something as extreme as, I'm going to go work for a Silicon Valley startup. That's not what I'm recommending to everyone. Yeah. Doing internal moves, either sideways moves, or even just getting on different projects, mm-hmm. there's probably something going on that's going to be a bit more exciting. And depending on where it is that you're working, they're desperate for people to put their hand up and say, oh yeah, this cutting edge thing that like no one really knows about. Yeah, I want to have a go. People will really thank you for it. I guess the closest to home is doing a different project or your next project, trying to sign up for something that's a bit different. If that's not possible, sideways moves are a great thing to use in a career. As someone who's done many sideways moves in their mm-hmm. lifetime, a sideways move is always so much easier, a lot more about what it is that you're getting into. You can speak a lot more openly about things. That is great. So if you are working in one of these larger companies and you're thinking, oh no, we're never going to innovate, I guarantee somewhere is innovating. And so thinking a bit like that. And then the kind of last resort is more going to a new company, which is a big step. And I appreciate that is changing jobs is hard.
Yes. Yeah. But it's a great way to then do the litmus test for yourself. Hey, do I have a lot going on elsewhere in my life that I'm okay with this pace? And I'm going to just openly acknowledge that. I'm not learning a lot. I'm putting my brain on coaster while I'm at work because I have something else. And then there's times where, you know, that which hopefully happens more often for people, where it's like, hey, I'm ready to click. I'm ready to go. Let me learn. So then asking yourself about, am I in this culture that's going to let this happen? And I love that kind of idea of the sideways move, because I have observed that in other companies where they may not be as experimental, but if you do that, raise your hand to do something new and different, it's almost like that creates some safety and saying, oh, we're going to move Sally over here because she's never done, but she's the only person who raised her hand. This is great. And so that there's a little bit more safety that can't, even in risk averse cultures, that can be created by somebody raising their hand to do something nobody else wanted to do and then pursue something new and experimental.
Mm-hmm. And again, back to the AI point, I think that's what's great about what's going on mm-hmm. at the moment is so many people are self-taught. So many people are doing something new. I think about Spark and Databricks to some extent, which has been around for 10 plus years. Mm-hmm. And if you're getting into that today and say, are you competing with people that have been doing this for like over a decade? Mm-hmm. That's quite terrifying. But to be like, hang on a minute, you're not that, you are an expert. But like, you're an expert after 18 months of experience. Why can't I be an expert after 18 months of experience?
Yeah.
And so that's why I think that now is a really great time to be able to try and innovate these things, even if you don't necessarily go down the LLM route. Like, there's a lot of people moving around at the moment. And I think now is an opportune moment for people to really try new things.
Awesome. So what has Databricks learned about enabling learning and development that you can speak on? That you can speak on.
That I can speak of. Yeah. So for context, I don't work in HR. If there's a really weird cut right now, it means it's not been signed off. So yeah, I don't think it's a big secret. We've acquired Mosaic, mm-hmm. wonderfully successful. They've done some fantastic work. But now we've got the rest of the organization that didn't come from Mosaic having to learn about all of these different things.
Mm-hmm.
And Databricks is absolutely fantastic for learning new things. And if anything, people say, oh, I'm quite overwhelmed by how much I have to learn.
Yeah.
Because again, it's a really big platform, and I don't think one person's got in-depth knowledge across the entire thing, except maybe the CEO who knows everything. But there's a lot that's going on there. And again, not everyone is necessarily technical. If you think about the employees needed to get a company to work, you've got sales who are maybe they've done software sales for a long time, but this whole AI thing is a very new thing to do. We've got people like marketing. We've got the legal team who have to now understand the ramifications of this. And again, because we're on the cutting edge, not many people have done this beforehand. So it is a real challenge. And again, I would say there's a lot of learning that we have. There's lots of opportunities that we have. The vast majority of it is learning by doing. There is big investment in making sure that we have the best people to be able to do this particular thing. You can't necessarily fire half the sales team and then go out and hire AI sales teams. And that's not how it works. You have to work with the team that already knows a lot of the context of the way that you exist. Yeah, without wanting to get too much into specifics that will then be hastily edited out, there's a lot of learning that goes on. There are regular things that are happening. There's regular workshops that are going on in terms of people curating what it is that we need to know. There's a lot.
Yes, yeah, it's just a way that the brain works. But you talked a lot about safety and identification of, am I in the right culture to learn? And am I the culture that fits me for where I am today? So if I'm low growth because this is my state, that's okay. But accept that and accept the progress that you can be able to make. But knowing, I think a key thing that you talked about is that accountability. Look to the actions that the org is holding everybody to. What are they holding you accountable to? And if it's just purely financial metrics, you probably aren't going to learn much. But if it's bigger than just financial metrics, then you can look and say, I can learn a lot. I need to make sure that what I want to learn is aligned to what the org is holding people accountable to. As you mentioned, Databricks, like, you're a data company. There's zero tolerance for not knowing data fundamentals. Okay. So I now my North Star is, like, I know what my North Star is. And this year and probably for the next couple of years, it's AI. Everybody's going to need to be learning a whole lot about AI. So now I can simply ask myself, all right, what I want to learn as a person, is aligned to the company? Is the company holding this learning accountable, or is it punishing people who try to learn and experiment? Like, these are all great questions we can ask, figure out, am I in the right environment for me? So thank you for your insights today. This has been great. And Holly, you're very active, obviously, on LinkedIn, which is how we got introduced. So if folks want to catch up, where are you going to be in the coming months?
So a big one that I'm going to be in person at is Data and AI Summit. So if you are listening to this before June and you're in San Francisco, come out, come see us. If you are not, you can still find me online. I'm fairly active on LinkedIn. If you search for Holly Smith Data, I think I'm one of the first results. Oh, just Holly Smith Databricks. I think just Holly Databricks. You can come find me, and I post a lot about Databricks and the features that it has and how it's going to be useful for you. So yeah, by all means, give me a follow.
Awesome. Thank you, Holly. Appreciate it.
Thank you. This has been so much fun. I really enjoyed this chat.
Thank you for listening and being an advocate of the data culture community. Curiosity intersected with data can inform and inspire change for the betterment of all. Let's build cultures to make this happen. If you have a topic, want to be a guest or chat, reach out to me, Sid Atkinson, or my co-host Lee Harper on LinkedIn via DM or via the Data Culture Podcast LinkedIn group. If you haven't already subscribed to this podcast, please do so anywhere you get podcasts. Be sure to join our LinkedIn group to engage with your fellow data culture changemakers and visionaries. Thanks again for listening.